Shalom, everybody. Welcome back to another special episode of The Pulse of Israel. Today, we are going to be super, super focused on a topic that I am personally extremely connected to, and I speak about a lot, I visit a lot. We're talking about the Temple Mount, and I am about to talk to two superstars who really place the Temple Mount, who are helping place the Temple Mount to be the central focus for each and every Jew and the Jewish people, like it should be. So I want to introduce you to two superstars, Dr. Melissa Jane Kronfeld and Rabbi Yehuda Levy. So both of you, thank you so very much for being here today with me. So let's just start in. Why is the Temple Mount an issue that you are so involved in? And for those who don't know, you go up to the Temple Mount like twice or three times a day, twice a week sometimes, and you run a yeshiva where every day you and others go up to the Temple Mount. Why? Why is this so important in your lives?
I think what most people don't realize is that for centuries, the temple, the Beit HaMikdash, was the organizing principle of Jewish life. Everything revolved around it. It defined our society, our personhood, our peoplehood, our nation, whether it was what we were building in the desert as we were moving along, or when we stopped in Shiloh, or as we made our way down to Jerusalem. But for centuries, everything we did, how we practiced our faith, how we lived as Jews in the Holy Land, how we were as human beings, revolved around the temple. And when that temple was taken from, we always talk about the destruction of the temple, but when the temple was taken from us, when the temple was destroyed, it's so much more than that. People don't understand. We talk about it, particularly now during the Ninth of Av, the destruction of the temple. We lament, we cry, we mourn, but it's more than just the destruction of a physical entity. It's a destruction of the organizing principle of Judaism. And the reason why we are in the situation that we are in today, the reason why the diaspora remains outside the boundaries of Israel, the reason why we remain in a constant state of war and under threat from our enemies is because we have refused to recognize that there is one thing that God asks for us. I mean, well, there are 613 things that he asked of us, but there's really one thing that he asked of us when we left Egypt, was to build this space where he could dwell amongst us. And you know, we have to believe in our hearts, if you're religious or not, that this is the fundamental crux of who we are. And we are neglecting it, refusing to rebuild it, and ignoring it as who we are religiously, nationally, politically, spiritually. Then we have to recognize that it is the most important part of the Jewish, the faith, people, and the nation. And for me, rebuilding the Beit HaMikdash and bringing attention to this cause, I think, is the last step in realizing the Jewish dream. And I believe that if people actually looked at it from an objective point of view, they would see that it is the most important human rights struggle of our generation. Jews do not have equal access to their synagogue, and that there's nothing to be said. Place where two synagogues stood for centuries, it has been ours. Forget the rest of Israel, forget Jerusalem as a capital, forget all the political stuff involved. We built two structures there. Both of them were destroyed, and now we are being told that we may not rebuild another one there. That, to me, is a complete abrogation of my human rights, my freedom of worship, my freedom of movement, my freedom as an Israeli citizen, my freedom as an American citizen. And that's why it's important to me, Rabbi.
Wow, you touched upon so many issues.
Sorry.
We're going to break down. No, it's awesome. Yes, Rabbi Levy.
All right, I don't have nearly as a fascinating approach to this as my dear colleague, Dr. Kronfeld, has. To me, I grew up in a very yeshivish upbringing. I grew up in Lakewood, New Jersey, did not have any Zionistic fervor at all growing up. Israel was not even a place that we visited, let alone, you know, we cared about it the same way every Jew in the diaspora cares about it. One day there will be a Mashiach, and we're going to all fly on these eagle's wings, and we're going to come from America. But until that point, there's really not much to do. Yeah, we could daven, we can cry, we could sit on the floor during Tisha B'Av, but that's as much as it was really, you know, the crux of our human existence, our Jewish existence, was Torah learning, Torah learning, Torah and learning some more with the side of Torah learning. As we like to say, Torah Shelo Amanat Lasot, unfortunately.
For those who do not know, that's Hebrew for saying learning Torah to then not necessarily implement what you learn.
All right. Yeah, so then I came to Israel to study with a plan of being here for 6 months, and 10 years later, I'm still here.
Wow.
It took a while to really start to appreciate. I think the point that really hit home for me where I was standing was the yeshiva that I learned at they took us on a trip, and one of the rabbis that were in the yeshiva, he started guiding us along on the bus, and he was pointing out these landmarks. He pointed out, as we drove up Highway 90 in Israel, which is right near the Jordan River, pointed out the mountain off to the side, that's Mount Nebo, that's where Moshe Rabbeinu stood, and looked into the land of Israel. He pointed out a mountain here that the Mishnah talks about was one of the locations where they lit the bonfires on Rosh Hashanah, on Rosh Chodesh, to indicate the new month. And all these little things put together just hit me in with such force, like, wow, everything we spent on my entire, you know, young adult life at that point, learning about is real. It took place here.
Right?
It's not a fairy tale. It's like the Bible,
right.
Bible's true. It comes to life here.
And it really brought it home. Like, this is the place, that this is where our future is. And from there, you know, just learning more and more about different things, I came across the topic of the Temple Mount. And, you know, something that we've always discussed, and we want to be Beit HaMikdash, but it never jives with me, you know, on a practical level. Like, hey, you have all these rules of how to do this practically, but that's just to learn and not to actually do. And the more I learned about it, and the more I discussed with my rabbis and teachers, you know, the questions just kept piling on top of one another till the point where I it just was, you know, bursting out of me. I wouldn't say a midlife crisis, probably a, you know, an early 20s crisis of like, what am I doing here? If my soul stood at Sinai and accepted the Torah with the attitude of Na'aseh v'nishma, I will do, before I technically even understand, then, and that's what the command, that's what we accept upon ourselves, that's what we're going to do, then how can we let this great mitzvah just sit off to the sidelines? And after many months of discussing this and writing and looking and going to great rabbis and discussing it, I eventually got a halachic ruling that I should go to the Temple Mount. That was roughly about 5 years ago. And then as I went to the Temple Mount, then I started to see the...
Wait, and for everyone who says, wait, but I was told that rabbis say that it's forbidden for Jews to go up to the Temple Mount. How did you have a rabbi who said, no, you can go up, Rabbi Levin?
Well, it depends on how technical you want me to get in terms of the answers for your audience, but to make it very, very simple, the halachic way of looking at the rules are very simple. It's not a complex question at all. It all bases on the simple fact there are certain categories of impurities that are not allowed on the Temple Mount because they have to be purified beforehand. Some can be purified nowadays and some cannot. The one that cannot, because we're missing the ashes of the red heifer, is someone who comes in contact with a dead body. That area on the entire Temple Mount is less than 13% of the Temple Mount. Those that suggest that we do not know the location where the temple stood on the Temple Mount, therefore, wherever I might be standing on the Temple Mount, I might potentially be standing in this area that is the 13% that someone who is impure because of coming in contact with a dead body, which is a status that every Jew is considered in today, irrelevant of whether they have or have not come in contact with a dead body due to complex Rishonic law. As a result, people get nervous about it because the penalty is actually quite severe. However, those who look further into this halachic overview of this Torah topic will come to the conclusion very quickly that not only is it not clear where it is, it's quite clear where it is. Our longest standing tradition from the destruction of the Second Temple till today is very clear. The paper trail is very well documented, where it goes through step by step, generation by generation, where the Holy of Holies actually stood on the Temple Mount. So it's actually, once you get to this idea that we have a starting point where we can map out the temple on the Temple Mount using the precise measurements put forth in Tractate Midot and the Mishnah, it's pretty easy to map out where that area, the forbidden area, is, which can only be on the elevated platform in the center of the Temple Mount. As a result, if one would technically just go to the Temple Mount and avoid that elevated platform in the center where the Dome of the Rock sits, there's zero probability that they will enter into that forbidden area. Now, the rest of the Temple Mount, one has to purify themselves from a secondary level of impurity called Tumat Zav. It's complex. Please speak to a rabbi before you do it. But just the easiest way to break this down is that someone who has a discharge from their body needs to purify themselves through the halachic process by going to a mikvah. If someone does that and follows the rules laid out in Maimonides of how to treat the temple with respect, they are not only is it permitted to go to the Temple Mount, is it a great mitzvah, one of the great mitzvot that one can do. The Mikdash is, the Torah equates going to the Mikdash with keeping Shabbat, which every Jew knows that Shabbat is considered one of the most important mitzvot. It's
right.
One of the seven mitzvot that is equal to the entire Torah, as is Eretz Yisrael and, of course, the Beit HaMikdash. So even though technically there's no Beit HaMikdash today, one can definitely go on. And the rabbis who permit it obviously follow the baseline halachic ruling. Now, the rabbis that do not permit it will find some other, as we like to call it, a shoehorn pshat, where they're basically trying to come up. They have their answer. They want to say it's forbidden to go. And then they sort of try to, you know, smash in, like it was a person trying to get his foot into a shoe, a way to do it. Now, I'm simplifying this great and deep topic. There are legitimate opinions on each side. One should definitely look into it and discuss it from the rabbi, which is what I did. Once I got to that point, I came up to the Temple Mount, and to return to your original question, when I got to the Temple Mount, it shocked me how few people were coming and how few freedoms we had. I remember just even standing, just straight up, wasn't even moving my lips, and the waqif was in my face, yelling. Cops were coming. They said I have to move along. You know, if I continue doing this is your last warning. We're going to take you off.
What
am I doing? I'm just literally standing here, and that's when the anger started. That's when it just became not just like, okay, I'm coming here because I have a mitzvah to do. I have five mitzvot that I can accomplish every time I go to the Temple Mount in accordance with halacha, after going to a mikvah, not wearing leather shoes, walking with respect, not acting, you know, with callousness outside the eastern side, and all the other, you know, few halachot that exist there that Maimonides lays out very clearly. At that point, it really hit home to me, like, okay, this is ours, and yet not only does it not bother them, but it's not in their lexicon at all. Like, it's like you ask most Jews, your average Jew, you go into any great Torah academy, and you say, "Where's the Holy Sign of Judaism?" 99 out of 100 times, you'll get the answer: the Western Wall.
Even say 999 times out of 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Unfortunately,
yeah.
It's very sad.
Right? And the Western Wall. What makes the Western Wall? The Western Wall is because it is the Western Wall of the Temple Mount,
right.
Meaning that. I once gave this parable to a certain you know well known individual who came on who came to the Temple Mount. I told him, and he used this in his radio show, which was very cool. I said to him, praying at the Western Wall is like waiting your entire life to go to Disneyland. And you buy the ticket, you fly out to, you fly out there, you rent a car, you drive to the parking lot of the park, you park the car, you get out, you walk right to the fence, you stand by the fence, you watch the rides in the distance, you wait till the park closes, the gates are locked, you get back in your car, drive back to the airport, go home, and think that you went to Disneyland. And that's unfortunate. So that's when it really hit home that we have to make a change. There needs to be something that, we need to do something. Obviously, I'm not a person that is willing to do any sort of violence or social disturbances. That's not my thing. I'm a regular Torah Jew. I want to do something that will actually make something in terms of the Torah, how to move our collective freedoms forward. And that's when I got involved with the founding Yeshivat Harabait, which is a group of dedicated Avreichim who go up every day. And we've seen over the 5 years that we've been in existence, even more so over the last 2 years where we founded our kollel, how much just being there every day and working and doing the things that we want to do, how much we've been allowed, like, for example, the ability to daven with a minyan. Originally, it was like you just mumble the words and Chazar HaDashan has to be basically whispered, to now it's being said out loud. People are answering, Baruch Shem Kavon Malchuto Le'olam Ve'ed, which is the standard answer that one gives to the Chazan during Chazar HaDashan on the Temple Mount, and Birkat Kohanim, and, you know, we hope to continue going forward. We have full Torah classes there. You can find this all on our various social media and YouTube pages, and you can really see the difference that has caused. And then about a year ago, I was privileged to meet Dr. Kronfeld on the Temple Mount, who we've interacted via Facebook before, and we decided after working on together on some projects that we need to find a way to broaden the people, broaden our reach for people that want to come and are afraid of coming to the Temple Mount and that are not necessarily looking to do it in the context of the yeshiva, and we decided to found Together High in the Heart, and I'll let Dr. Kronfeld pick up from there.
Wait, so before you continue with High in the Heart, I just want to point out to people, you see this beard? First of all, it makes me look very old. I'm getting older, getting more white with each year. Some people say it brings respect, but I'm growing it because that's the sign of Jewish mourning for the destruction of the temples. So it just happens that this is the week we're now having this interview and talking about the very important work they are doing for generating the awareness for the Temple Mount for Jews and non-Jews around the world, the centrality of the Temple Mount to the Jewish people. But that is why I'm growing this beard. And Jews all over the world are in a mourning state, the 9 days as we lead up to the saddest day of the Jewish calendar, the 9th day of the Jewish month of Av, when both Jewish temples were destroyed. And in connection to what Rabbi Levy was talking about before, and Dr. Kronfeld was mentioning also earlier, there is a sadness that I also hold on to, that not enough Jews today have a central aspect of their Jewish identity with the awareness of the Temple Mount and even Jerusalem, but specifically the Temple Mount, to their lives and what is missing in their lives today as Jews. And again, Rabbi, you could talk about this more than I can, but I mean, I just know there are three, every single time Jews pray, at least 3 times a day when we say the Shmona Esrei, at the end of the Shmona Esrei, 3 times a day, we talk about the return to the rebuilding of the temple. But yet, how many Jews are really talking about, how many Jews are really focused on that or thinking about it, or what are we doing in our time to really bring it about? Hardly any. Which brings me to you again, Dr. Kronfeld. One, high on the har, and two, Rabbi Levy, I understand, Yeshiva Bachar, he's interested. People might look at Dr. Kronfeld and like, wait a second, what's your connection? How do you fit in? Where did this come from for you?
So I'll start by talking a little bit about how I got up to the har, and then I'll tell you a little bit about our project, High on the Har. I've always been involved in my faith. People obviously may not look at me and see the same kind of yeshivish look that my dear friend and partner and colleague has. But being a religious person was always extremely important to me. I grew up in a Reform family, but from there, it wasn't really enough for me. And when I was 17, 18, I met my first Chabad rabbi, and it sucked me in. From about 17 to about I would say probably about 30, I was deep in the Chabad space. I didn't move to the Crown Heights. I wasn't, you know, that kind of Chabad, but that was where I attended shul. That's where I really learned about Judaism at the Orthodox level. And so when I came to Israel, you know, when you come here, you can't avoid living a Jewish life. You live a Jewish life here in a very different way. And so my Judaism rapidly increased. And I've always been a big fan of the rabbis that are pushing the needle. I've always been a big fan of those people that are fighting, not just for Israeli rights or Zionism, but fighting for Jewish rights, which is a fundamentally different thing. We often talk about, oh, I'm pro-Israel, or I'm Jewish, but what we don't talk about is the fight for, there are specific Jewish rights that are being ignored, that we are being fundamentally depressed, that we don't have today as Jewish people, that there are certain people fighting for, and one of those heroes is Rabbi Yehuda Glick. And I'm part of the, been part of the Glick Click for, you know, I'm part of the Glick Click for as long as
but
I can.
To give people context, yeah. Rabbi Yehuda Glick was a person, and I remember those days, he used to sit outside of the entrance to the Temple Mount on a hunger strike for months. A hunger strike. He only drank water because the authorities forbid him from going up, forbid all Jews, specifically him, from going up and visiting the Temple Mount. And he was a central figure in the movement for access.
He was,
to
and
Jews.
He was shot point blank range 5 times by a Palestinian Arab, I believe it was a Palestinian Arab terrorist, who shot him point blank, and he survived and lived. Our movement is built on the backs of giants, and that one of those primary giants is Yehuda Glick. And so even though it wasn't necessarily a Harabit, which is why I was a part of the Glick Click and why I was such a big fan of his, he was just one of those rabbis that, this is a man that stood for Jewish freedom and Jewish rights. And I always really admired him. And one day, the opportunity, my friend Mayor Oded Ravivi in Efrat said that he was hosting Yehuda Glick in Efrat. I was like, oh my God, please, can I come?
Just so you can meet him.
So I drove all the way out to Efrat. He was talking to a group of young people young people that are visiting Efrat after having spent, I think, a few days in Bethlehem. So they are getting kind of the both experience. And Rabbi Glick was there, and I waited, you know, I waited for a moment, and I went up to him, and I was like, oh my God, I'm your biggest fan. And he was like, that's, you know, that's cool, I guess. And I was like, like, what do you say to that? Like, how many rabbis do people come up? I'm like, oh my God. But he's a giant in my mind. And he was like, well, you know, why don't you come by the office one day and tell you about the work that I'm doing. As I told him about the work that I do, running a social impact consultancy. And I said, if there's ever any opportunity to help you, I'd be happy to. So I went to his office. I couldn't have been much longer later. And he told me about his incredible organization, the Shalom Jerusalem Foundation, which is focused on fighting for equal rights and access of Jews in the Temple Mount. It is his life's ambition, his life's work is now embodied in this amazing organization. And I had the really blessed and unique opportunity. He asked me to fight help him. I built up the organization and do fundraising, which is what I do professionally. And at this point, the Beit HaMikdash, the Temple Mount, really didn't mean anything to me. In fact, I would say, this was 2 years ago now, I didn't even think I knew at the time. I'm trying to think back because I'm there so much now. I don't even think I thought I could go. And I think the second or third time I was in a meeting in his office, he's like, do you want to go up to the Har? And I was like, I can go to the Har? And he's like, yeah. And I was like,
I didn't even know.
And one of the reasons why I tell people that part of the story is because if I didn't know, and here I am, you know, working with all these Jewish organizations and fighting for Jewish rights and having made Aliyah by myself and being such an ardent Zionist and someone who's so involved and so impassioned and worked with all of them, had the great opportunity to work with all these giants, I didn't even know that I could go up there. How can the rest of the diaspora and how can the Israelis know? And so the next day, he took me up on my first trip. It was wild. It was like straight Glick Click, you know, madness. And he brought up lots of people, and he's praying, and he's singing, and he's on the Zoom, and there's people calling him from around the world. And I was just like, my mind was blown, and I never left. I just never left the heart. Just that was it. It was it for me.
And everyone, if you're not following Dr. Melissa Jane Kronfeld, you should, and then you'll get your daily inspiration via her. Posts seeing her visits up to the Har.
I used to think that there was something wrong with him for going every day, like once a day. Yeah. And now I go 2-3 times a week and I'll make 4 or 5 ascensions in a single day. Like today we did 4 ascensions. We started up there around 7 a.m. and we finished at 3. And I used to think that that's so odd that he does that. And now I don't even get to see him anymore because I'm there.
So can you touch upon that? And then you also, Rabbi Levy, what is so special about visiting that place? What are you feeling when you're up there that attracts you to be there and go more than once a day and a number of times a week? What's that special feeling?
For me, it's really simple. This is the house. This is God's house. He's there. Like, God is everywhere. God is a part of our lives. We can pray. We're very fortunate Jews. We can pray to God. We can access God. God is present always within us, around us. He answers our prayers when we need him. We can call out to him. We can lean on him. We know that, he's made this earth so it shall not falter, and he'll always lift us up when we're down. But if you actually happen to want to actually be with him, like that's where he is. And when you go up there, I can't explain it. He is absolutely, or it, I shouldn't amorphize God, but God is absolutely right there. His eyes and his heart will dwell there forever. And forever and ever. You feel it. You absolutely feel it. When you walk out from the gate onto the actual area that is the Temple Mount complex, it's a bizarre experience because the sun is always shining. Now, granted, we are up on a mountaintop, but like the sun is actually shining, even on a rainy day. It's just there is a magical feeling. It's almost like if you've ever been in a place where you felt electricity in the air because maybe you've been in a field or there's been sort of magnetic something, you've been in an earthquake, all those kind of natural phenomena that happen in life that we actually feel air or we feel, you know, the particles that exist around us. That's what it's like. That's the major part for me. But over time, because I spend so much time there, another really big part of it now for me is the people there. As Rabbi Levy was talking about between Yeshiva Har HaBayit, Be'edenu, and organization that you're very actively involved with, from Tom Bisani, and a bunch of other activists and organizations. There's a core group of about 30, 40 people that are there every single day, rain, shine, heat, cold, snow, rioting Arabs, angry police officers. It doesn't matter. They're there every single day. I'm part of that group. Rabbi Levy's part of that group. And it's a community. It's like any other community you've ever been completely bonded to, a camp community, a school community, a yeshiva community, a family. But there, it is the most unique group of people I've ever been with in my life. And I grew up in Manhattan. I've traveled the entire world. I've been privileged and blessed to have every opportunity that any person could ever want or have. But the my Har family, it's... There's nothing like
her Har family, right? That's the Temple Mount. Her Temple Mount family.
It's astounding. We've got the people, the backgrounds. We are so diverse. No one would, and there's no other place in the world where this core group of 30 or 40 people would ever be together. I mean, just the fact that me and Rabbi Levy, you know, that we're partners and we create this organization together and we're working so hard on fighting for these fundamental reasons. You could just see that the differences between us. So you could imagine now pick 30 different other people that are nothing like him, nothing like me.
Mm-hmm. Some don't even speak a word of English.
Yeah. You know, we have been all different backgrounds, all different, they've come from all different countries. They've transformed and changed. Everyone up there has a story, a transformative story that has made them committed to the Har. And none of the two are the same. But they are magical and brilliant. And when you collect and you hear these stories, you realize this is a very powerful place. There's absolutely no way that 40 people could have such miraculous things happen to them. Unless it has something to do with the same thing that they're doing. We're all going to this place. We're praying and we're fighting quietly and we're pushing the needle and we're bending and breaking the rules and we are slowly ending the apartheid that exists on the Temple Mount. And miraculous things are happening to all 40 of us.
Wow.
And it has. There's only one organizing principle behind that, and that's the Temple Mount. And that goes back to what I said in the beginning, is that the Jews have lost the organizing principle. They have lost what has bound them together for centuries. They have lost the thing that God wants them to have most and which can keep them, you know, both in his favor and in the favor of ourselves. So,
your turn, Rabbi. What's your feeling? What's that special feeling for you up there? And then I'll throw in mine.
Yeah,
it's hard to say in terms of, it's hard to quantify it, really. Mm-hmm. There is something unique that's there. Mm. Now, what's fascinating is that according to the Torah, the times that your average person were to go up to the Temple Mount was three times a year. And that was considered the ideal,
yeah,
right? There was a active mitzvah for one to go up to the Har HaBayit, to the Beit HaMikdash, during Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuot.
By the way, on that point, I'm very lucky. Back when I was a yeshiva bacher 30 years ago, I purchased, and my parents purchased for me, this special machzorim, right? The special prayer books we use for those three holidays, Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuot. That is the Temple Mount prayer books, where the whole focus is on the Temple Mount. Mm-hmm. Because so many Jews today, we say those prayers on those three holidays, totally disconnected from the ultimate purpose of those holidays, which was the Jews to connect to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And yet those are the Machzor I use.
I'll just add to that before I go back to the question that you asked me, was that, you know, I grew up in New York, in the New York area, right, like I've mentioned before. And it's considered standard, unfortunately, for people to go to their parents for the holidays, especially those that are similar to me that have moved from the diaspora to Israel. You know, at the end of the day, it's hard to live here by yourself, especially without any family. And people have this urge to go back home to be with family by the holidays, and everybody can understand such a thing and concept. And yet, I get a lot of pressure from my family members, like, oh, why don't you come for Sukkot, come fly over to America for Sukkot, we'd love to host you. Well, you know, we can't wait for you to see you, to see your kids, we haven't seen your kids in so long. And it kills me, this idea that I'm sitting here in Israel and I hear the Torah, and I'm gonna have to listen to the Baal Koreh, the person reading the Torah scroll on the Chag, say the following words: Shalosh pamim bashana yireh kol zchurachat bnei Hashem lekecha b'makom esher yivchar. Three times a year, you should see it. You should see Hashem your God and at the place that He chose, right? B'chag Matzot, b'chag Shavuot, b'chag Sukkot, at those three holidays. And I would think to myself, like, here I am. It's one thing if I was living in diaspora for whatever reason, and I said, you know what, okay, that's something to aspire to. One day I'll be able to be at the on the mountain and be there for the holidays by the temple. But like, I was literally in Jerusalem and I said, you know what, God, nah, you know, I'm just gonna go to America now. You know, you tell me to be here three times a year, I'm gonna say, you know, I'm just gonna head out. So that's something that really irks me as well. So yeah, that should add to your point. Now, back to this overall general, question. Ideally, a person would go to the Temple Mount, and by extension, the temple for very specific purposes, right? You know, the person doesn't just walk into a courtroom, and to use that as a parable, right? You don't just go to the courtroom for no reason, right? You go there to connect to something or to take care of a certain type of business. Going to the Temple Mount has been set aside since the dawn of creation, since Adam, since Noah, since Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, wherever you look throughout our long history, the Temple Mount was always the central location for prayer, for supplication, and for repentance, since the dawn of time. So much so that the Midrash tells us that the first thing that was ever created was the Evan Shetiyah, the first stone, which from there the rest of the universe was created. And that stone is currently located in the Holy of Holies, which is now unfortunately covered by the Dome of the Rock.
That's the rock.
That is the rock. Mm-hmm. Sakhra in Arabic, right? Evan Shetiyah in Hebrew. And that is the place where everything, you know, the first thing that has ever been created, and that's where our sages teach us is the doorway to heaven. So yeah, it's set aside as the premier place for prayer. People would go there for all reasons, and not only that, when Solomon built the temple, God actually gave him his guarantee that prayer would be answered there. So in terms of a premier place, people spend all sorts of money and do all sorts of things and travel all over the world to go to that unique place where they're going to be able to connect to their creator, whether it's by going to a gravesite of a holy tzaddik, a righteous man, or wherever it is that they feel that they could connect to, whether it's going, people unfortunately even leave the Israel to go to the diaspora for these things. And yet you have the one location where God himself has given his guarantee, as Dr. Kronfeld mentioned so beautifully and eloquently before, and my eyes and my heart will be there for eternity. When God answered Solomon's prayer, those were the words he used. He said, I heard your prayer, I accept it, and I choose to leave my divine presence right here for eternity. So yeah, it's not just a place that we should be, you know, technically just going carte blanche. There has to be a reason why a person wants to go there. That being said, when everything I just said would be true if the temple was actually mm-hmm. still there. But right now, the reality is the exact opposite. Right now, unfortunately, those that are there defile the place constantly with soccer, with, you know, or football if you're from the UK or anywhere other than America.
Swordplay.
Yes,
calisthenics, snowball fights.
Today we
picnics.
Saw a hula hooping class.
Hula hooping class.
Which is fascinating. Burqa hula hooping class.
It breaks your heart to see the way the mount has been
treated. Garbage everywhere.
It's
piles of trash, broken windows, lattices. I mean, it's outrageous. I mean, you know, you really have to like extend yourself, like to say, to make something into your third holiest site. You know, like this is our holiest site.
Right.
But like, you know, like you have to imagine like how little it means to somebody when they're calling it their third host. Like, that's my third favorite child. You know, like, nobody says that. It's true. You know, nobody says that, right?
No,
you know, but, like, that's what it's really like. Like, that's, you know,
that's
my
great.
Third favorite dog. But that's what it is, and that's what they say about it. This is not their first. This is not their second. And it's really, and if you saw how they treated it up there and what we see every day, I don't even know how they can call it their third.
I use all the things you just say as proof saying, that's not even their third holiest site.
Yeah,
they don't give any. They would not treat a holy site of theirs in the despicable way they treat the Temple
Mount. You know, and what people may not understand if you've never been there is that and this happens on a daily basis. An Arab will drop a piece of trash on the ground, and a Jew will go pick it up. And the person who's in trouble is the Jew.
Yes. Right.
And we do it, and now we do it, and we push, and we do it anyway, because then the cops are faced with an existential problem. And we're always trying to, we're trying to put the cops in this kind of existential space where they have to kind of weigh the absurdity against the morality of the decisions that they're making up there. And one example of that is picking up the garbage. Okay, so that guy throws a piece of garbage on the ground, I pick it up, and you tell me that I can't do that. So what's your next step? Are you going to take the garbage from me? Are you going to let me throw it away? Or are you going to tell me to drop a piece of garbage back on the ground on a site that you know is holy? And in the end, most of the time, we either get to throw it in the trash or they'll take it from us, and they're not going to throw it on the ground either, because once it's in their hands, they realize the absurdity of the situation. And that's one good example. Another good example is, you know, the breaking, what we call like the breaking of the water fountains. For a long time, people were not allowed to drink from the water fountains on Harbite. And so
non-Muslims were forbidden from drinking.
Right.
Muslims
so,
could drink if you were.
Yeah. So that's what we, so what we started doing is, and Rabbi Glick was a big kind of progenitor of this, so he did it to me, actually, which is why I did it to other people. We would tell people who were making their first trip to the heart, oh, why don't you get a glass of water? Here's a cup. Why don't you get a glass of water from that water fountain? And the person would go over there and the cops would scream, you can't do that. You're not allowed to take water. And the person would be like, why? Oh my God, I'm so sorry. What did I do? And they'd be like, because you're Jewish. And the person would be like, what do you mean? You only Muslims can drink from that water fountain. And we would record these interactions. And the absurdity, the pure absurdity of a human being's innocent desire and want to get a glass of water and a cop screaming at them that they couldn't because they're a Jew eventually wound up breaking that conduct up there. And slowly and surely we've taken over one water fountain and then another. I have my eyes on a third. But like, you know, I do. You know which one it is too, the one when we go around the long route. But you know, if your viewers and your listening audience right now can't understand or see the direct parallel to the civil rights movement in this water fountain example, right? The civil rights movement, Black and Brown Americans, were able to break the back of racism in America, which I believe they certainly have, by saying, I will drink from this water fountain. And if you want to arrest me, arrest me. I'm going to come back the next day and drink from that water fountain. And that's what we did. And so we followed in the footsteps of the great civil rights leaders. We followed in the footsteps of peaceful protests. We followed in the footsteps of, you know, civil disobedience. We're not out there doing, as Rabbi Levy said, you know, he's a man of Torah. You know, he's not interested in causing violence. He's not interested in throwing stones or rocks. I know that if I had a place so nice under my control, I wouldn't be breaking things the way the Arabs and the Muslims are. I wouldn't be throwing my books the way the Arabs and the Muslims are. I wouldn't be knocking things down and lighting things on fire and breaking antiquities the way the Muslims and Arabs are. And so what we do instead is we show slowly and surely how banal and belligerent these rules are and how we can bend and eventually break the back of apartheid that exists on the Temple Mount for Jews only, because yes, Israel is an apartheid state and it is only the Jews who are suffering.
And with that being said, so that's why once we saw this great need, and talking over with our esteemed Rosh Yeshiva, the head of our organization, Rabbi Eliel Weber, he said it that may be true, going up three times a year would be in the case of the temple, when the temple stood, but nowadays it's not only is it our right, but it's our responsibility to be there as much as possible, because the more Jews that come to the site and act in accordance with halacha and act in accordance with the awesomeness, the ema and the yira in Hebrew, that we treat this holiest of sites, the house of God, the palace of the king, the more freedoms and the more it will be viewed as a Jewish site. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the Israeli government views the site as a Muslim holy site. That's why Jews, when they go to the Temple Mount, or for that matter, any non-Muslim that goes to the Temple Mount, are called visitors. We're not called pilgrims. We're not called, you know, people that are there. We're referred to as visitors. All right. They'll report. The police will report every day how many visitors came to the Temple Mount. Visitors. This is our home. You're the visitors, mm-hmm. But they don't view it that way. And the reason why they have to view it that way is largely due to you know, our fault as a nation, but it's also takes a direct responsibility for some of our own conduct, because we can talk about how much the Temple Mount is important to us, but actions matter. And if we're not willing to go there and act as if it is, in fact, our holiest of sites, mm-hmm. then we can't expect our enemies to do so. One of the things we show on our tour is something that I hate to even describe in person because it breaks my heart every time I see it, is that on the Western Wall, the very wall, the very Herodian wall of expansion that all the Jews pray, what they call the Kotel HaMaravi today, the Western Wall, in that very same wall are two graves, the graves of King Abdullah of Jordan, and a crypt of six bodies. I'm not going to mention all of them, but one who stands out in particular, may his name be blotted out, is Abdul Khadr al-Husseini, who led who was the Mufti of Jerusalem's right-hand man and led by proxy his war against the Jews between the years of 1947 till 1948, before he was killed thank God, by in Castel, and he's buried in the Temple Mount. He's buried on the holy site of Judaism. This enemy, who's responsible for how many countless, of maybe even hundreds, of Jewish deaths, is buried in our holiest of sites. And not only does it not bother us, but nobody even cares.
Most people don't even know. Even if they knew, most people would not care.
Mm-hmm. And as I said, when people see it for the first time, they're usually shocked. Like, how could this be?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the place where we can point out and say, well, if we don't care about our holy sites, how can we expect our enemies to care about it?
Mm-hmm.
All right. We can talk for hours. This is such an important topic. And again, as you hopefully are hearing about, these are two superstars on the front lines raising the awareness for more Jews, everybody, but specifically more Jews, to be not visiting, but to be going up to the holiest site to the Jewish people. And I want to finish up by finish up with Rabbi Yehuda Glick, because it's very important. Something that Rabbi Yehuda Glick always teaches about, it's a very simple teaching, actually, from the prophet Yeshayahu. And he basically explains to us all. The prophet tells us, right, the Temple Mount is supposed to be a place for Jews and all the nations to go up and pray to God.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the secret to the power that the Temple Mount will release, that God will release via the Temple Mount when we as a people, as the Jewish people, reclaim the Temple Mount. Because it's not just a place for us, the Jews, to go there to pray, for all nations to go there to pray, and that's when we're going to really merit to have true peace. Today, when we live in this progressive world of appeasing the Muslims who terrorize us and use violence against us constantly, that doesn't bring any peace. That pushes peace further away. Only when we reclaim our place and all are allowed freedom of worship, thankfully, because the Jewish people will reclaim our holy site and allow Jews for freedom of worship and going up there whenever, always, and other people are allowed freedom of worship as well, those are going to be the days when we're going to be merit the times of peace. So by the work they're doing and raising the awareness, and for you on your next visit Israel, you're going to make sure you're going to take time and go up to, not to visit. It's hard to come up with another word.
Make aliyah. Make aliyah. You're an aliyah.
Right.
You're an immigrant. It's like you make aliyah to Israel. We make aliyah to
the heart.
And that's why
we
welcome home everyone who comes with us. We always start by saying welcome home, because it is your home, whether you're Jewish, you're Christian, even if you're Muslim. If you're willing to respect this holy site and really understand who it belongs to and how it needs to flourish, we welcome a place. That's why there's a courtyard for the Gentiles. There's a space for everybody there. And we hope that when you come to Israel next, you come visit. We lead tours every single day, Sunday through Thursday, during the times that Jews are permitted on the Mount, which is only during those days and also not on Muslim holidays. But we lead tours at 9:30 and 1:30 every day on Har HaBayit. And you can find us on highonthehar.com or at highonthehar across social media, as in I am high up on the Har. And we so look forward to sharing this experience with you, because you have to imagine that if we're there every single day, multiple times a day, there must be something really special there that you're missing out on.
So thank you, Dr. Kronfeld. Thank you, Rabbi Levy. Continue this really, really holy, holy work. And everyone understand, you will be part of bringing the redemption by going up to the Temple Mount, and not just once, but twice, and making it part of, again, reclaiming this as part of our identity, and we'll be able to bring true peace to the world. So thank you both of you for the time today, for this interview, for your amazing work, and thanks to all of you for watching. And so once again, I'm going to sign off from the eternal and ancestral homeland of the Jewish people. This is Avi Abelo for another Pulse of Israel, and if you support the work we do by focusing on these issues, like the importance of the Temple Mount to the Jewish people, as well as all the other politically incorrect topics, which shouldn't be politically incorrect. This should be the most correct topic for humanity. The Temple Mount is important for humanity, that the Jews reclaim our own holiest site. But you know me, I deal with all these other politically incorrect issues, unfortunately termed that way by the mainstream. If you support the work, just visit Pulse of Israel, subscribe, and every once in a while you want to donate towards the work we do, go for it. Thanks everyone for watching. Shalom from Jerusalem.
Pulse of Israel, frontline videos from the Holy Land. Support our work by donating today.